Commentary Track. Conversations with film historians and filmmakers. With your host, Frank Thompson.
Hello. Welcome to episode 60 of the Commentary Track. I'm your host, Frank Thompson, reminding you that the days of thrills and laughter were in the teens and twenties, and that today is a bottomless pit of horror and despair and hopelessness. So, happy days. Today we have part two of a two-part interview with Sam Gill, one of the great film historians, says I. And it's another corker, I think. Sam is just a great talker, gives us a lot of family background and some funny stories. And the highlight of this episode, I think, is his talking about Calton C. Lehue. As I think I mentioned last week, Lehue was one of the early film historians whose work I read in depth, because when I first started buying books on silent film, there really wasn't much out there. And Lehue was turning out things, especially during the 70s, hand over fist. And for what I required at the time, it was top-notch stuff. And I really think that he went there earlier than a lot of people, and he talked to some of the major people. I know that he's a figure of some controversy these days, but he meant a whole lot to me when I was first starting to learn about silent film. And Sam co-wrote a book with him. I had forgotten about that because I forget things. When he brought up Lehue's name, it reminded me that I'd never met anybody, I think, that ever knew Lehue. And so it was a great opportunity to hear some stories. So what that means is now I need to find Calton C. Lehue himself. He just sort of disappeared. He's the Garbo of film historians. He just stopped in the early 80s sometime and then just vanished from the face of the earth. Everybody I've asked seems to think that he's still alive, so anybody out there with any connections to Calton C. Lehue, let me know, because I would love to talk with him. There's that and lots of good stuff on this episode, and I enjoy talking with Sam so much, and I hope that you enjoy listening to it. So settle in, and I will see you on the other side.
But I guess I probably should explain about being interested in film history. It isn't, I guess, just film history. And like I mentioned, I think I was pre-programmed that maybe they'll prove eventually genetically there's some gene, probably a gene mutation,
yeah.
You know. But you could sort of see, even for survival of the fittest, if you think about it, and I often think about survival of the fittest and how today that works in our culture today. And I think, well, it works in many, many different unusual way. And that's kind of like the revenge of the nerds, because, you know, in the electronic world, well, sometimes the people who were the most lost, nerdish people there were, who were brilliant at what they did, well, they are the most sought after people in the world,
yeah,
pretty much now. And also in science and technology and all that.
100 years ago, they wouldn't have lasted a day.
I mean, very hard, very tough. But I think, well, but there must have been some reason why. Well, I think the reason is anything that involves your brain and higher intellectual capacities, it has the survival of the fittest angle, because brute force is not always the answer.
Sure.
And as much as I admire brute force, because I never had it, I always envied brute force. I always wished I could be more like that. But I did have that interest in intellectual things, or thoughts, you know, thinking and philosophy to a certain extent, but definitely history. And history kind of interested me. And I think how history and people who are interested in history is survival of the fittest is, you keep things, and some of those things will be useful to defend yourself, to keep yourself alive. Because you've learned things that you can pass down to another person who is interested. I've always noticed in school that there are those who are book learners and those who are not, and you tended to fit usually into one category or the other. And if you were a book learner, that's kind of the people I'm talking about, is you survived because you were interested in remembering things, keeping things, and you could pass that on, and that could be reworked, you know, better mousetrap sort of thing. And the others who maybe are not particularly interested in intellectual things, but wow, they're adept at everything else, though. And at what the intellectuals maybe are not, the absent-minded professor, for example,
yeah,
will forget, and you know, a horrible thing happens because he forgot. But the guy who's a hard worker, he never forgets, and so he's there working. And so I've always thought there's plenty of room both ways. And when I was born, gosh, some of my earliest memories, you know, I can remember, I actually remember a few things when I was in my crib, and I also remember learning how to walk.
Wow.
I have a capacity to remember. My brother, George, actually remembered the things that were up above his crib when he was still lying down. So he had a memory that went even further. And the reason we know that he did is he brought that issue up in his teenage years, and I was a witness to that, and my mother said, "Honey, that's impossible." And he said, "Well, I do remember exactly what was above my head." And she said, "Okay, then describe it." And he proceeded to describe exactly what was over his head, because my mother knew what it was, the things that he was describing.
Yeah.
So, you know, and I have another brother who's just as brilliant. So, more with numbers than words, and I'm more verbal. As everyone who's listening to this will realize, that can be a detriment too, I'm afraid. But
not here.
Not here. I think I do believe in people are pre-programmed. It doesn't mean that you can't change things in your life, and you certainly can do anything that you want, or at least attempt to do anything that you want in your life. But there sometimes are just talents. I cannot sing. Boy, do I can't tell you how many times I've wished listening to a recording of Enrico Caruso, you know, or listening to a current singer today, or anyone with a really good voice. I just, you know, that's a great thing that I don't have anything near, and I wish I did. But I have been programmed, I think, to have this natural interest in history, and it may have helped other things, too. I've asked other people interested in film history, when did you first know that you were interested? And it's interesting how some people say, well, it was when I was 18 years old and I walked in and saw this, whatever. Or they were at Disneyland, saw the little show there on Main Street, you know, on the Nickelodeon, and I was fascinated. Or Steve Radzuski said that it was the first time he saw films with this strange cross-eyed comedian. And he thought, well, who is he? And he couldn't find it. And eventually, he found Daniel Blum's A Pictorial History of the Silent Screen, and he says on page 222 was, and he even memorized the page number, and I checked, and it is page 222, is a marvelous picture of Ben Turpin staring right at you. And it said Ben Turpin. So there's something there, too, that was almost pre-programmed. Why would he even like Ben Turpin? But yeah, he did. So, but some things were in our home, which was a little bit like the house and you can't take it with you. There was a lot of what might be considered insanity in most homes happen on a daily basis in my house as I grew up. So there are a lot of amazing and weird and strange but wonderful things that happened in my home. And we were always doing things, and my dad early on had bought a projector. He was into film and photography also. So he had been shooting home film in the 30s, 16-millimeter film, and then resumed that in the late 40s and 50s. And so he bought some films. The one that I remembered the best was The Paper Hanger's Helper, which is actually just one reel of a Bobby Ray and Oliver Hardy film called Stick to It, where they're paper hangers.
Yeah.
But more people know of it as Paper Hanger's Helper because it was issued as a one reel. And it was advertised as Laurel Hardy. Well, it's Bobby Ray and Oliver Hardy. But that used to show that. And for some reason, I was probably more intrigued with that. So again, why would I be more intrigued with that than the cartoons he was showing? My brothers were more interested in the cartoons. I was more interested in the comedies. And then my brother George said, well, I showed you a lot of those too. So I said, okay, I'll give you credit too. And then my mother was one of those rather unusual cases where silent film, she was actually more in love with silent film than sound, but only as a film goer. She didn't collect films or even seek them out, silent films, but she was born in 1916 in a small town called Lyons, Kansas, and her father was the editor of the local newspaper and got free passes all the time. Well, again, now this is interesting. Her older sister was not interested in movies or even going outside. She wanted to stay inside making doll clothes or whatever. My mother couldn't wait to get outside. It was a big tomboy named, her name was Mike, and she raced up and down the street, knew everyone in town, and went to every movie she could. So for her, it was like, well, there's never been a dog like Strongheart, though. And people who know about dog stars, you know, they think, oh, didn't she mean Rin Tin Tin? No. She did not mean Rin Tin Tin. She meant Strongheart. And there were definitely those camps of Strongheart lovers and Rin Tin Tin lovers. And so things like that, or she'd say, you know, Harry Langdon was one of the most unusual comedians, which anyone who's ever seen Harry Langdon comedy would have to say they're unusual and original. He was probably one of the most original comedians who ever worked in the entertainment business. And so I'd say, well, what was he like before I got to see him? And she would do imitations. And then her Stan Laurel, she did a very good little Stan Laurel thing. And but then what was also fun was at that time in the 50s, a lot of these people were still alive, and some of them were still working in the entertainment business. So we'd be watching a show on TV, right? And in those days, there were three networks. That was it. I mean, you watched whatever the networks had for you, and you'd decide you'd watch. And so she'd go like, oh, my God, Neil Hamilton. She had a crush on Neil Hamilton when she was about 10 to 12 years old.
Well, of course, she saw Beaugest in 26.
See, you know, she was crazy about Neil Hamilton. And in fact, it was a bit of an unrequited love affair, I think, going on there, you know, between him on the screen and her as a child. And so there were, and Lloyd Hamilton, that's another one she said.
Really?
She would say, Jackie Gleason is doing nothing but a Lloyd Hamilton imitation, and it's not nearly as good as Lloyd Hamilton. Well, I hope Richard Roberts is listening to this because, you know, he has probably the world's largest collection of Lloyd Hamilton films. And the critics often said, this is original. Unfortunately, the great majority of Lloyd Hamilton's films don't survive. And unfortunately, some of the most crucial ones, where he was experimenting on a different form of humor, he, like Langdon, pulled it way down slower.
Yeah.
He slowed it way down and did a lot of visual and reaction shots and stuff. And that was great. You know, Norman Targ worked with him. And so I was able to ask Norman Targ, what did you think of Lloyd Hamilton? Oh, well, there was no one like Lloyd Hamilton. What he could do with his facial expressions. And he said, no, there was never anyone. And I said, well, that little odd walk. And he'd say, oh, well, no, that was from a foot injury. I mean, you know, it was great to get the truth behind things.
Sure.
He said, what? He says, well, yeah, that was at Calum. He had he fell down running down the hill and broke his foot. Really? And it never healed properly, and he always walked with this odd limp after that. And so he just decided to incorporate that, not only like a little shuffle, but this kind of odd little waddle thing. And so it worked out well because his foot would flare up quite a bit from time to time. Well, you know, that was like, oh, my God. What a great story, you know.
Yeah.
But
I don't think I ever knew that.
I don't think many people did. But my mother would say things, and of course what she was talking about was the poor soul of Jackie Gleason had different characters, and one of them was the poor soul. And it was kind of, well, I think actually Reggie Van Gleason had some Lloyd Hamilton in it too. And I think
the later, physicality of Reginald Van Gleason was kind of Lloyd Hamilton.
So that may be even the one that's more. But and then so I had this kind of, oh, there was no one ever like. Ken Maynard was her favorite Western star, and I think I've only seen one Ken Maynard film in my life. And she would say, oh, they're just not like Ken Maynard. She was kind of caught into this, and eventually she said, you know, silent film should never have ended. She said, you know, silent films should have coexisted with sound films. She says, I always felt they should, and it was wrong that they just died and they were killed, and they should not have been killed. She said, the theater should have offered both the silent and the sound because they're two different art forms. Well, can you imagine? That sounds like a lecture we might give at our theater here.
Well, sure it is.
But hearing that from her, and, you know, it was like, well, boy, I'd like to see some of these things, you know. And then on TV, there were a few shows that I could barely get because our reception wasn't very good, but The Silence, Please, were on a channel that I couldn't get very well. But I would glue my eyes to the TV set anyway, and we had two TV sets. There was Sam's upstairs, which, like, all those things that no one wanted to see. And even as a kid, I learned how to run my dad's tape recorder. He had an Ampex tape recorder, and I'd record stuff off the air. You know, so sometimes I have some things that are kind of interesting. And he was recording things off the air, too, that now are very historic. He had a wire recorder, also from the late 40s. So he had some things that were on wire as well.
Wow.
And Dad had an interest. You know, everyone in my family loves history. That's pretty unusual.
It is.
On both sides, also on my mother's side also.
Wow.
And so they all kept everything. Of course, what happened is they all passed on. It went down to my parents and then the parents to my brothers and me. So we're all like under a mountain of stuff. You know, I think we're all at our age beginning to feel like, well, maybe we need to do something about some of these things. And if they have enough historical significance, I think some things should go to museums and other things to
the rest of my house.
The rest to Frank Thompson's house. Yes. Because, well, he's a man in need. anyone who knows Frank.
Believe me.
Now, I want that.
Everyone knows
that. Be
sure
and put that in this podcast because I go, well, he's a very fair-minded person. Because Gil was going on and on about saying terrible things about Frank. But, you know, if each of us weren't crazy in our own way. I forget who it was that said, there's the OCD. I remember when I first learned about that, you know, I thought, well, that's kind of interesting. I wonder if that has something to do with collecting. And then someone who loved watching movies but didn't collect, and so he was being sarcastic about the dealer's rooms at Cinecon, which are coming up shortly. And the person said, well, I think they also should have a booth as you go in that has a psychiatrist is in, you know, kind of like in Peanuts, and this OCD, you know, information, pamphlets, booklets, books, and everything that is for free. This needs to be for free because, who knows? Most of the guys are probably collected anyway. You notice I said guys. There are both women and men who are into the film history stuff, but when I was first growing up in it, I don't remember any women interested in it. That seems to have been more of a gradual thing that, and more and more are.
Yeah, early on it was really a boys' club.
Oh man, it was. There was one person called it the Stooge Club.
Yeah,
because you know, not very many women like the Three Stooges, and I forget who it was that coined that term. I think it was one of the early Cinecon individuals who said, well, you know, there is a stooge gene that most men seem to, you know, inherit. Yeah. And there's a lot of truth to that. That, you know, I watch kids, and the kids usually who are poking and jabbing and kicking and hitting, especially their younger brothers, are the boys. You don't see a lot of girls naturally kicking, and there are some, maybe in defense.
Sure.
When their hair is being pulled and or being kicked by the boys, they may react that way, but it still is somewhat in the, I don't, of course, that's a whole other issue, but.
Yeah, even now I tend to think that slapstick in general is more prized by men than by women, although I know plenty of women who enjoy slapstick, but the balance is way off.
Well, you know, Richard Roberts and I were just having a phone conversation the other night. Richard is a great film collector. He's called the world's tallest film collector.
He is indeed.
He's 6'8", and has a magnificent private collection, and then knows where all the bones are buried anyway, or the reels are buried. And so we were talking about Hammond Budd and the Kalem films, which are anarchic. And we were also talking about, he was trying to explain to people about Keystone Comedies, which were produced by Max Sennett, were actually spoofs. And people say, well, they were shot off the cuff and they're very rough and crude. And he says, no, they are not crude. They're very well made. You have to understand what he's kidding. And of course, Brent Walker in his book on Sennett pointed out too that Sennett was actually remaking a lot of D.W. Griffith's biograph films, using the storyline, a very serious storyline, and punching it up with gags. And if you look at, because if you really look at some of the Keystone storylines, a lot of them don't have a lot of story, but it'll be, that looked familiar. Where did I see that? And it'll be a biograph film that Griffith made. I can't imagine what Griffith must have been thinking when he was sitting in the audience seeing these Max Sennett comedies. They must have talked about that because, you know, I'm sure he would have probably kidded Sennett, say, you know, I think you owe me residuals for all these comedies because, you know, these are my story. Of course, he stole those stories from everybody else. But anyway, we were talking about Keystone and how anarchic it could be. And then Richard said, but then you have Henry Lehrman, who took it even a step further. And Lehrman had been with Griffith at Biograph and with Sennett, but he went another direction. And Norman Targ had worked with Lehrman. So when I met Targ, I said, I'd really like to ask you about Henry Lehrman because he was nicknamed Suicide Lehrman, as you know. To work for Henry Lehrman was kind of, you were signing off your debt, your death certificate, because he put through people through such dangerous things. And Targ did tell me, he gave me the answer to that. He says, Well, you know, if he knew he could get a laugh from something, he would sometimes go a little too far. You know, I'm paraphrasing, but that's what he said. And that was, again, like, oh, that's interesting. And then I was asking, too, about, you know, his, anyway, I should really wrap it up. What Richard was saying is Henry Lehrman took it a step further, and then I said, and the White Brothers, because if you begin to look at Jack, Jules, Ben, Sam, all the white boys, I left out one there.
Yeah, are there five of them?
Yeah, Jack, Jules, Sam, Ben, and I'm really sorry I'm left
for me too.
Fifth one, but. They, a similar thing, they came in under the Senate, you know, Jack White can even be spotted in some of the Keystone comedies, like Fatty Joins the Force. He's one of the kids in that. Lou Breslow is also in that. And so he was influenced by Keystone, but he was fired from Keystone. And so he went to Henry Lehrman, and then so you have him working with Lehrman, and then by the teens and 20s, then he's interested in very broad slapstick, and he begins to create almost Keystone-like gags in the 20s when everyone else was not doing that. And so he was kind of this link from Senate Lehrman, or Griffith Senate Lehrman and White Brothers. And why I bring them up is they were the producers of most of the, at Columbia, of the Three Stooges.
Sure.
So you have a continuity, a parallel line.
Yeah, everything, you know, I find that I have this argument with people quite a bit, that people seem to think that every era supplants the era before it. And so what we like now is one thing, but what was happening 10 years ago was absurd. And how could we have ever dressed like that? Or how could we have worn our hair like that? Or anything. You know, that was stupid. Now we're fine. But in fact, history is just a stream. It's a constantly flowing river. And everything leads to something else. And everything is part of the puzzle. And that's what's interesting to me is, it just exactly as you say, tracing from one thing to the next. And who was there and what did that lead to? It's like this wonderful puzzle that just keeps getting filled in. But it leads directly. I mean, you can go straight from Max Sennett to Jim Carrey or beyond, and there's a direct line that goes there.
Yeah.
And every part of that is an essential part of that trail.
The way I was looking at it, early on I began to see this, were parallel lines. I see that in a lot of things. It's definitely in social trends, you know, society's trends of things. You almost always have parallel lines. And what I noticed in screen comedy with parallel lines was that it didn't just start and stop. Not really. Because someone else was there to take it over. Or you had a younger person who is points in that direction, in one direction, and the one in the other direction. And so you also had quite sophisticated comedy at the very time you had the Lehrman and Sennett, which, they're sophisticated in some ways more than people think they are. They're very well-made films. And the sound effects to Three Stooges come, to pull out those sound effects, I mean, or the in the cartoons. Yeah. You know, the voice, Mel Blanc, if you didn't have Mel Blanc, you know, for example, our whole cartoon industry would have been slightly different. I mean, even as kids, little kids growing up in a small town in Kansas, like, that Mel Blanc is fantastic. Yeah, isn't he? I mean, and here we were, I was probably 6 years old, you know.
Sure.
And we knew Mel Blanc because it became obvious. We kept seeing voice characterizations, Mel Blanc. And who?
Nobody else did all
of them, you know. And Roy Barcroft. We all knew the villain in most every other Western seemed to be Roy Barcroft. You know. Later it was like Blackie, Charles King.
Yes.
So you got to be Charles King or you know Roy Barcroft or forget it. This is not a real Western, you know. and if there were girls in it, and especially kissing, I remember my brother George saying, "Oh my God, that was so good." And I said, "Oh, darn, I'm so sorry I missed it. Why? There isn't a single girl in it." Now, see, that's another male thing.
Well, sure.
That's another Stooge Gene thing.
Yeah, too. When you're a little kid, you don't want any kissing stuff. That's for sure.
And certainly no guitars in any Westerns in Sterling, Kansas. In the matinees in Sterling, Kansas, throughout the 50s, there was not a single singing cowboy. And I've told that to Bob Burchard. You know, he kind of looks at me like, well, I don't give a damn, you know, because he loves the singing cowboys. But those parallel lines, because just at the time that you had the pretty wild slapstick going on, and that's, I won't get into that, but you also had the sophisticated comedy like John Bunny, to a certain degree, who was a personality-driven comedy. What they weren't that funny, but he was a character. And the Drews, Mr. and Mrs. Sidney Drews are as clever in an original way as I think anybody like, working today.
They're like drawing room comedies in a way.
They're drawing room comedies. Yeah. And Charlie Chase was an interesting case because, you know, I was just watching all these Keystones. God, he's in so many Keystone films. But even then, he does the burlesquing and the slapstick pretty well. He can keep up with most of them, but there's something missing. He's not quite like them, and that's in a good way because he was the next stage of in his development of making it more sophisticated and slowing things down and having more thought-driven comedy, kind of like Buster Keaton.
Yeah.
You know, Charlie Chaplin, although he became more thought-driven, he wasn't particularly thought-driven in his early films. And he even said, well, the character, I learned early on, it's the character that people are interested in. And the tramp character that sure. he developed. And incidentally, Niles is where he shot the scene of him walking away from the camera
yeah.
at the end of the road, where he's walking down the road, which is at the end of the tramp, was shot in Niles Canyon. And David Keene, our historian here, can literally take you to the spot, as he did with Kevin Brownlow, who, of course, produced some of the most fantastic things on Charlie Chaplin and other everybody else.
Kevin had no interest in seeing that, I'm sure.
And he had never been here.
Wow.
And I got to ride along. And I wish that I could convey the look on Kevin Randall's face when David pulled the car over, stopped, got out of the car, and pointed and said, that's where that scene was shot, because David figured out, due to the contour of
sure.
the surrounding area, where it was exactly, and also exactly where the camera would have been for him to see it. And the expression on his face, I can't describe. I don't know whether it would be, I'm home at last. I'm home at last. I don't even know how to express it. But I was so glad I was there. And
there's something special about seeing those places in reality, and that's why I love coming to Niles. And last year when Kevin was here for Napoleon in San Francisco or in Oakland, he was staying in San Francisco at a bed and breakfast place, and I interviewed him for the podcast there. And then afterwards, he and my wife and John Bengtson and I were going to go to lunch, and he said, well, before we go to lunch, I want to show you something. And we walk about a block down, and there on the corner is McTeague's dentist office from Greed. And it's exactly, it looks like it. And it doesn't have a big gold tooth hanging outside, but otherwise, instantly recognizable. And there it is. And I always say stuff about stuff like that. You either get it or you don't. You know, when I took a scale model about the size of this table out to the desert and put it up where Fort Zinderhoof had stood and put it up exactly where the original had stood on the sand dune and took pictures of it and I thought, people either understand why this is fun or they don't.
Yeah.
And the people who don't, I can be cordial to, but I could never love them.
You know? I love that. That's great. You know, there's something about, I wrote a little afterword. I'd never been asked to write an afterword for a book, but Steve Massa, who's absolutely unbelievable
when it
comes to his knowledge of American silent screen comedy, is unparalleled. And I'm so glad there's someone out there who's like that. And talk about continuity. You know, it's funny, when he said when he was a junior in college, he discovered a book called Clown Princes and Court Jesters. Well, that was a book that myself and Cal Lehu wrote. And we wrote it in 1967 and 68, and it was published in 1970 when I was in the Army, thank you very much. But I came home on leave, you know, and my sister-in-law was there, and she has this funny grin on her face, and she goes, ta-da! You know, there was the book, my book. And I thought, oh, my God, it's out. I didn't even know what the cover looked like. So, but anyway, Steve told me a charming story. It means a lot to me. He says that when he was a junior in college in Ohio, he was becoming interested in silent film comedy. But there just wasn't anything out there about the lesser knowns, you know. Everything was about Chaplin or Keaton or Lloyd or whatever. And he runs across my book in the library, at the school library. And it has, you know, brief profiles on 50 silent screen comedians alone, most of them who were very lesser known. And so I think the most famous probably were Laurel and Hardy. We just barely put them in, and then everyone down below her, who we thought were all worthy of it. Actually, we're going to do 100 of them, but the publisher decided to do 50 first and then never did the second 50. So anyway, so this book is out, and Steve said he found it, and he goes, "Why, this is almost like a dream come true. I mean, this is fantastic." So he checked it out, and he just couldn't bring himself to turn it back in. So he renewed his checkout, which you could do at the school at that time. And so when that was up, he renewed it again, and he did the same thing through his senior year also. He checked it out and renewed it over and over and over again. But at the end of his senior year, he thought, "What am I going to do? I can't steal this book. That's not right." And he said, "And I'm not a student here. I can't check it out." So he photocopied the entire book.
Wow.
He said to take along for his future years. And anyway, you know what happened. Of course, as soon as you do something like that, then you find a used copy.
Well, of course. Yeah.
You know, and so
for $2, yeah.
Yeah, so he found a used copy and bought the used copy. But it was kind of fun because for his new book, which is called Lame Brains and Lunatics, which I was able to supply the picture on the cover too, which is of Hank Mann in drag, which is a scary thought. a girl with a brush mustache. So anyway, he said, Eileen Bowser kind of discovered me, you know, like how much I was really interested in film. And there's a case, too, where, you know, he asked, could he come to the FEOF conference? Because they were having a slapstick symposium that Eileen Bowser at the Museum of Modern Art was putting on. And she was hosting the FEOF members there. And she was going to show all these rare silent, in nitrate, all these rare either fragments, unidentified films, underidentified films, or, you know, are they worth preserving? Because in those days, most archives didn't preserve short films, or it was very rare that they did. And so she wanted to know, would these be worth preserving? And I was invited back there, too. I don't remember meeting Steve, though, at that time. But Steve was very young, but he already knew quite a bit. So he called and talked with Eileen Bowser personally. And she said, oh no, you couldn't come because this is, for one thing, it's a part of a FEOF conference. And I couldn't just invite people in. Well, she knew that she already invited me, and I was not a FEOF member, and the Academy was not at that time. And so I think she knew, well, you know, it's not entirely true. And he said, well, I was just hoping maybe you'd be showing, you know, maybe I could help you, you know, if they're like, you know, the Three Standard Fat Men and the maybe Dippy Doodads. And he tossed a few obscure name of comedians, and of course she knew right on the spot, this kid knows something. I need someone like that. And so she wrote the foreword to his book, saying that because Steve says that's kind of when I was the moment I was discovered, because once Eileen Bowser, you know, sure, gave her stamp of approval, you were like gold. I mean, you know, she said a funny thing about me too. She says, "Oh, you're a great discovery of mine," you know, because she did. I wasn't known on the East Coast, and so when she was showing all these films, you know, I'd say, "Well, oh, you've got to preserve these," because none of their Hank Mann comedies would run through the projector. And so she'd say, "If there's time, we'll look at it on a flatbed." Can you imagine?
Wow.
Maybe I shouldn't have even said this. I'm not sure that was authorized, but anyway, that's what we were doing. So if the nitrate was too shrunken, we couldn't look at it, or if it had other damage to it. And so we imagine that's we were doing that. But anyway, so we looked at everything. I think it was 3 days, and looked through tons of stuff. And on the Hank Manns, I said, they must be saved. You got to preserve these. I'm glad I did, because even though we didn't know what the titles of those films were, eventually that information is known. I guess that's another part of my interest, and has been from the beginning, are the lesser known. When I would look at these books, I'd think, oh, well, but who's that? Yeah. Kind of like Steve did with, Steve Radzuski did with Van Turpin. I was fascinated. Well, who's that? Who's this? The first, I was interested in it before I found any books on it. I'm not quite sure how that happened that way. We had one of those little Carnegie libraries that was built in 1917. That, you know, Andrew Carnegie left a huge amount of money for small towns all across America to get grants to build libraries. And his thinking was that as a young man, that the difference between his success and not success really was education. And so he thought, what better way to support education than to build libraries? God bless him. So I was able to grow up in a small town with an outstanding library, beautiful one too. And so, but even as a kid, you know, the librarians would try to usher me over to the children's section. Couldn't care less about the children's section. I would always go to the biography section or the where pictorial works were. Or other. It's curious. Even in school, I mean, in grade school, my kindergarten teacher played records for us kids on a, and we don't even have records now, you know, but they were 78 RPM records on a 78 RPM record player. And so I remember being fascinated with these disc recordings with a certain sound.
Yeah.
And then I later found out my mother had some of her mother's records, and she let me play those once she realized I was careful. So there's still this kind of pre-programmed things. But at the library, you know, there was a biography on Andrew Carnegie, of course. You had to have that in the library. And then there was one on Harry Lauder, and that was fascinating. And then and the fact that he made some sound movie, really? Because I had records of Harry Lauder. And then, so I found these other books. Lewis Carroll was of great interest, and Jules Verne, and a lot of things. And so, and then if I found something on a movie subject, I learned how to, I taught myself to type. My mother had her father's little portable that he wasn't using anymore, and all Kurz Manual. Something else that's gone. And so I taught myself to type so I could type out the articles or, you know, the parts of a book that were of interest to me. Because I was also interested in circus clowns. That was another early interest I had. And so I would get books, you know, by Fred Banta or George Sherwood, who was an old-time clown, whatever, and other circus books, and I type out everything I could. Slivers Oakley, you know, how many people talk about him? But, you know, I was fascinated with those, and a few made the crossover into films. So I was interested in those two, but I was also interested in the lesser knowns, and that seems to be from the beginning. And it's kind of curious that my brothers are both specialists also in specialty fields. My brother George is an anthropologist, physical anthropologist, who believes the truth is buried in the ground in its bones. That's the truth, because sure. You know, he says, oh, I can tell a person's race much easier from bones than I can from a picture or in person. Now, the word race is very, very touchy subject, but my brother believes that it's a good thing. Race is a good thing. And so he often lectures on the issue of race. And he's also a forensic anthropologist who is brought bones, and are they human or not, by the police department. Because Are they human or not? If they're human, can you tell us anything about who this person was? And so they had at one time in Wyoming, he's at the University of Wyoming, they had the highest conviction rate of their forensic lab work done for the police department in Wyoming, leading to capture and convictions, because from the bones, George could reconstruct what they looked like, you know, their age, sex, any physical illnesses or, you know, diseases or what, on and all sorts of things. And then there was a woman there, I think she's still there, who could do a model of the head, what the head looked like. And then they'd photograph it and give it to the detectives who would take these photographs out. And people would be interviewed and in some cases would say, oh, that's my cousin, the missing cousin. Well, now they had the bones when where it was. Now they know they can go from there. And so he's examined Custer's last stand, you know, the bones there, how some of the soldiers were shot from up above, right? He said, which means they were on their knees and they were executed by Indians with rifles. Mm. So it's kind of like, ooh, that's creepy.
It is creepy.
Yeah, but George has always been fascinated in origins and the things that no one else seemed to be interested in. And my brother Paul is a medical doctor who'd like to retire, but is still working pretty hard, part-time. And he's a hematologist with a specialty in leukemia and blood diseases.
Mm.
And to ferret out the truth of the disease of whatever patient he has. And I thought, you know, it's just amazing in a way that my brothers and I all, you know, I think it's through genetics, you know, that we got double barrel here from my mother and my father of having this intense interest. I mean, we're probably the only family on the face of the earth that on trips where all the kids say, since their vision's a little better than their parents' vision, would say, oh, there's a museum coming up. Let's stop. Or we'd say, there's a historical sign over here, Dad. Now, the only thing my dad wouldn't stop for were antique stores. Mm. And so if I'd go, oh, Dad, there's an antique store. I cried everything because I was interested in antiques, you know. And he hated antique stores. He liked history, but he didn't like antiques.
Really?
And so that's kind of a funny thing because you have three kids jumping up and down saying, oh, there's an historical marker. I mean, I don't think that happens very often. That three brothers who basically are out to kill each other, that's the purpose of most brothers.
Sure.
We have to clarify that up front. I have to tell many mothers this because, you know, they don't have an understanding of once they start having more children, and there are now two boys, that precipitous dangers all of a sudden begin to occur and bruises and one beating up on the other.
Sure.
I always liked how Eisenhower, who of course we Kansans claim as a Kansan, you know, even though he was born in that little state south of Kansas down there, you know, near Mexico. But Eisenhower told a story that when he get in fights with any of his brothers, and he had a host of brothers, you know, they were always in fights. And the one thing was his mother would say, go outside and the winner wins. The winner decides. This was very true. I mean, that was, without knowing that was going on, that was very true. And my mother would say, take it outside. Now you boys stop that and take it outside. And it was with a tacit understanding that the one who won makes the decision. But the only problem is my brother Paul weighed about twice what I did. And this was not fair. So, you know, I grew up with, and of course he laughs at that now. And I said, well, I didn't laugh then, you know, and you weren't laughing either, you know, but anyway, I didn't plan to diverge so often.
Well, it's great to hear the family stuff is crucial.
Cut all that.
I cut nothing, Sam. But we do have to wrap up soon because we've gone really long. But yeah. I need to double back a little bit before we go because you mentioned somebody that I know nothing about and I've always wondered about. And I will preface this by saying the first time I ever met Bill Everson, I mentioned something that I was looking for, and he said, oh, are you interested in silent film? And I said, even though it was a lie, I said, oh, I'm such a silent film fan that I named my dog Calton C. Lehu.
Oh, my God.
So Those were the very first, except for Immortals of the Screen, which was the very first book on film I ever bought when I was probably 13. But the Calton C. Lehu books were really the first things that I bought, and I think I bought them all. I mean, I had a pretty good shelf of his books, and I never met anybody who knew him. I never met anybody who knew anything about him. And now I meet you. Well, I mean, I've met you years ago, but I didn't realize that you knew him. For some reason, I'm not familiar with that book, and of all the other books I had from him. But tell me a little bit about Calton C. Lehu, because he's one of the first real film historians, and he was writing about a lot of stuff that to this day nobody has written that much about.
I agree wholeheartedly. The first I ever heard of him was in a little publication called the 8mm Collection,
sure,
which grew gradually into the Classic Images that it is today and has been published from 1962 straight through. In fact, I just gave my entire collection to the museum because I had about 300 issues of it from the beginning, number one. And when I first got a hold of that, which was, I forget what issue it was, maybe 6 or 7, something like that, I saw these articles by a guy named Calton C. Lehu. And I was intrigued because I thought his angle was different and interesting. And so I began to read what he was writing. And as you mentioned, the first books that started to come out, I kind of think Continued Next Week might have been that I think was University of Oklahoma Press. And right offhand, that's the first one I can remember that came out. And I kind of forget when I got it, but I know that when I saw that book and I started to read some of his writing, I thought, well, he seems to be delving into original source material here and interviewing people. He's obviously interviewing people who were active eyewitness to the times. And he's obviously reading the trade magazines of the time, of which I'd only seen a few by that time, and the New York Dramatic Mirror, a few things. So I became more and more intrigued with him, but at a distance. And then I proposed to Sam Rubin that I start a column on the lesser-known comedians called The Funny Man. And Sam, I said, I don't know what you pay, but you know, I'm sure whatever you say would be fine with me. And of course, he said, are you kidding? You think I paid for anyone on this blankety-blank magazine? And so I started my series. And here's what's interesting is I wrote a piece on Larry Seaman with a filmography, to the best of my ability, which was basically copyright catalog information because I didn't have access to the trades to get the release dates on all the films, but I had all the copyright dates. And so I published that, and so guess what? I get a card from Calton Lehu saying, your piece on Larry Seaman, really outstanding. You know, dear Mr. Gill, you know, very outstanding. A fan letter, can you imagine? A fan card, anyway. And so then at the end he said, but you did make a few mistakes, and said that such and such was released in this date and this date. But otherwise, outstanding piece. And so I was thrilled, you know, because I knew he was writing these books. And he was working one on comedy, which became World of Laughter. And he was also researching other topics. What happened, I think, the next thing was I was planning my trip to Hollywood. I had finished my sophomore year in college, was going to go back for junior and senior, but that summer I decided to go to Hollywood, to which my father said, oh no. But anyway, I did. And So we set up a meeting. I met Cale Yu in person, and we started to share information. And I realized that he was a real kindred spirit. He was very interested in topics that had never been written about in the area of film history, and he had a natural great interest in the silent screen, especially beginning around 1910, going up to 1930, not particularly interested in films later or earlier. Pre-1910, not particularly. But as far as I could tell, he had gone through every issue of Moving Picture World from 1910 to 20. And I think he was doing the same with some other publications. And so his knowledge was unlike anyone's I had met yet. And so I was very impressed with that. But what he was intrigued with is all the people that I was planning to interview. And what was going on in, well, let me explain. He was from New England. Vermont, I believe. I'd have to double check where he was born, but I know that he degree was in history, and he taught history, I think even in high school for a while, and in fact taught history out here. He lived in the Bay Area at one point, and so sometimes when we were corresponding, it would be back east or it would be up here, Mountain View, or in the L.A. area. And so as I got to know him better, I learned several things. One is that with the Vietnam War going on full blast, I knew that I was either going to be drafted or, you know, I would need to enlist. And so that was preying on my mind. And so he had was a Korean War veteran, which I very few people have ever known about. And so We talked about what his experiences being a Korean War veteran, mm-hmm. and also his interest in history, and his interest in film history kind of came from his father, who was a huge fan of the movies. And you know, that's a little bit unusual for fathers to be the fans of the movies. A little bit like Joe Adamson's father was a huge fan of movies too, and my dad was not particularly, my mother was. But so we would talk about that, and how he said, I believe if I do this right, that I'm going to be able to make a living being a film historian. Now that's a real important part of the story. So he decides, well, everything I'm researching is going to build on each other. Kind of similar with Tony's Life, in a similar way. Well, whatever I research, I can put aside, and I'll use it for something else, anything I don't use. So Carol was building some marvelous stuff, you know. And the people he was interviewing kept leading him to other subjects, like, well, tell me about them. And then they had died, like, you know, in the 30s or 40s. And so he was getting information on people who were no longer alive. And that was happening to me, too, and we were sharing information. It was like, boy, this is, you know, thank God we're here and talking with these people. And he also was very interested in photography, and I was so interested in photography that eventually I almost went into graduate school in photography at CalArts, which I did 1 year, actually. So we had photography also in class, to a certain extent, classic cameras and so forth. So Cal says, I said, well, what are you working on next? Well, I'm doing this. You know, he decided there was a lot that needed to be written about serials. And, you know, as far as I know, the serials have still not had the kind of attention that they should. For example, the kind of book that Brent Walker has done for Max Sennett, we all know there needs to be a book like that on silent serials.
Sure.
And I know that there are a number of key people who have worked on that, but they haven't published it or organized it and published it.
Yeah. Leahy's book is really still the best source.
You know, the first thing I did was index it because I found a lot of books, including Clown Princes and Court Jesters, wasn't indexed against my wishes, but it wasn't. And so, you know, I index a lot of books that I need indexes to. And so I had indexed the book, knew how much information was in the filmography section, which he didn't index. So there were all these credits that no one before had ever plugged in all these credits. So I had enormous admiration for him. But you know what was curious is that he had this admiration for me in the field of the silent screen comedy. And so he got the idea, and I've kept all my correspondence. I didn't remember he proposed this idea, and I responded so quickly by letter, but he got the idea we should do a book on all these lesser-known comedians, because there's, and he was a huge, not just a huge fan of Black Hawk Films, and it's funny we haven't talked about Black Hawk Films because I call most of us of this certain age group Black Hawk babies, because most of us first got to see our silent films from Black Hawk Film prints, and they were, of course, located in Davenport, Iowa, and Cal was extremely good friend of Kent Eastman's, who was one of the founders of Black Hawk Films, and he and Kent were very close, and Kent would loan anything that they had, as well as rare stuff that they decided not to issue. So Cal was seeing a lot of films that no one yet had ever seen since they were first run. So he now was seeing films that no one had ever seen. He was researching it in a way that no one really had before, and he was talking with the people who had actually been there. Well, as you know, he was cranking out books there. The University of Oklahoma said, "We've done enough." That particular book won prizes for being one of the finest produced books of that year. There was an award he got for that, for Continued Next Week. It's a beautifully presented mm-hmm. book, a bound book. I think you could drop that off the Empire State Building and it wouldn't tear apart. It's beautifully put together book, physically. So he's working on all these other topics, serials, photography history. He actually wrote some things on collecting. He thought there could be books for collectors about how you collect things. So he was doing sure. that. And then he decided to do our book, which was to be one big book. And then we'd said, no. And A.S. Barnes became very interested in publishing about film history. That's another thing. You had Black Hawk Films, and then you had A.S. Barnes, Inc., and mostly that was the editor, Thomas Yosloff, who thought there was a huge untapped field, and that was American silent film, going into even early sound film, but hugely untapped. And so Yosloff was eagerly signing up people. I had the wonderful opportunity of having, why don't we do this book? Because Thomas Yosloff is already sold on the idea. He wants to do it, but I'd like you to be my co-author. So I had literally a book contract put into my lap. I found some of my correspondences. Well, you know, there are a lot of different ways we could do this book. It must be very surprising to think that I could verbalize myself so much. No. But so I told him several things that it could be, which I just found that letter too. I laughed out loud about that. And in fact, I said, why couldn't we call it maybe The Silent Clowns? Which, of course, Walter Kerr used.
Well, sure.
He says, stop with that. I've sold it as Clown Princes and Court Jesters, and Yosloff loves it. So you just be quiet. You've got a contract, okay? Sign the contract and send it back. And I said, okay, Cal, you're the author. So I signed the contract, and then we had a new relationship, and I got to know his family better. His wife's name was Julie, and he had a baby son. I was there almost from the beginning. His name's Kevin. And so I became kind of a part of, you know, Kevin and Julie and Cal's lives. And he continued writing books. I think I might tell one thing that people wonder, who's Terry Brewer? Well, two things. Tamar Lane, there starts to be articles in the 8mm, and I think it was then called the Classic Film Collector, and you'll see articles by Tamar Lane. And I said, Cal, this is amazing. Tamar Lane was writing articles in the teens and 20s. Is he still around? And Cal said, "You know too much," because he said, "That's my pseudonym." So if people are wondering who the, you know, it's amazing. Tamar Lane writing articles in the 60s. Well, that was Cal AU. And he loves secrets, I discovered. So that was one of them. And then when this book came out, I was in the Army, but it was with Terry Brewer. I said, "Well, who's Terry Brewer? I think I need to meet Terry Brewer." And he said, "Oh, guys, that's kind of a sensitive thing," which I think I can talk about now. But he said, "You know, I thought maybe I'd used my name as much as I could. There's such a thing as too much exposure for some authors. You know, there's a greater interest if you sort of, what would you call it, delay release of certain books." And he said, I think I was losing the interest of some of my publishers. So I submitted that manuscript as Terry Brewer. And I think it was Barnes. I'd have to research that. But the publisher accepted the book from author Terry Brewer. So he had to call and say, "Well, I have some kind of egg on my face. Terry Brewer's my wife." Well, her name was Julie. Lady, it wasn't Terry Brewer. So he had made it up. And so...
Maybe he liked Teresa Brewer, and that was...
I don't know, but anyway, so he told the truth, and they said, "Well, it's too late now, but we'll put your name on top." So the book says Calvin C. Leahy and Terry Brewer. And now here's kind of the sad part of it. I had to go into the Army. I enlisted. I decided that was the way to go. So I was 3 years in the Army, and that's when the Conferences and Court Jesters book came out. And then Cal was had a couple of other books that came out. And then he was working on the Seelig book, which is kind of the only thing on... No, well, there's now a little bit more on Seelig. But at the time, nothing. No one ever talked about Seelig much. And that was the motion picture pioneer, Wingman Seelig. And that was a picture book, and... not too much research into it. And I said, you know, it's a marvelous book with the illustrations and the things that you've reprinted, but there's not much history. He said, there's no future in film history. There's just no... It doesn't pay. It doesn't pay the bills. You can't do it. And that was the first time I'd heard that tone of voice. And I mentioned about our book, you know, the second one. He says, "The whole thing's different. Barnes is not interested in those kinds of books." He says, "I barely got the Seelig book done." And he says, I'm not interested in doing them anymore, frankly. He says, "I've been doing some things on photography, history photography and so forth." And he says, "But, you know, where I'm really making my money now is Peterson Publications." Well, Peterson Publications is kind of like the Black Hawk Films for automotive enthusiasts. Sure. And publish hundreds and hundreds of publications about every aspect of the automotive repair field and automobiles and trucks and everything, and how do you repair them and everything you want to know about, and manuals and so forth. I didn't know that that was another part of Cal's interest. And so you might get a kick out of this. He said, "You know, I could use you as a model, though. Have you ever done modeling?" I said, "Oh, God, no." And he says, "Well, I need a model for Julie, and I trust you." And that's funny. I've had other people say that, too. Is, you know, "Will you take my fiancé on a date because I can't do it?" I don't know. Is that the Ralph Bellamy of this yes. film history club? Or I don't know. But I'm the Ralph Bellamy, I guess. But anyway, so I went on some photo shoots of vans, custom-made vans, that shows the great time you can have at picnics with your girlfriend. And Julie Leahy was my girlfriend. I don't know if Kevin was in those, but he would have been our baby, you know. Mm. So it's kind of mind-blowing now. But so he was into that. But I said, "Well, Cal, you've never told me about the responses to our book and to other books." He says, "Well, it was well received." And And I said, oh, I don't think I got anything on it. And he said, didn't they send you a packet? And I said, well, maybe of a few reviews, but no fan mail or at all, anything. He goes, oh, fan mail. I always throw that in the trash. And he says, in fact, I'm throwing all those letters in the trash. And I said, well, like what? And he said, oh, anything to have to do with film history. It's in the trash.
Wow.
I said, well, would you think consider giving it to me? What he did, he says, well, I have some of my photographs that I just got to get rid of. And they were the illustrations for some of his books. I kind of wish he had kept everything, but he gave me what he had. And it was for the Max Sennett's Keystone book, which, again, was going into Keystone.
Sure.
In a way that no one had before. It was interesting, though, that on the fly leaf, I said, I'd like you to inscribe it. And he said, to the man to the fellow who should be writing the next Keystone book. Because he knew that I had an intensity of interest that was the kind that was almost like Brent Walker's, you know, but I knew I'd never have time to do it, and Brent did. It took him 20 years, but he did it. But that's a bit of the story of Kalehu, is it's a sad ending because he eventually divorced. And he said it was the GD film history time period. He said, you know, we were living hand to mouth. And he says, we had a new baby. And I'm trying to support a wife and a baby on the money I'm making from film history books.
Sure.
And
that can't be done.
I think what happened is that it became such a sore point. I may be wrong, but I would characterize it as a building resentment that here I am putting out these extraordinary books and no one gives a damn. Because he felt that they would be almost like bestsellers. He was thinking the next step is with these film history books is they're going to take off. Because if you remember, they almost did. There was a time period there where you had people who remembered the silent era, who were now nostalgic up in years, and they were buying all those Barnes books.
Mm-hmm.
They had lived that. So you had a special little niche there, and then you had people with Black Hawk Films and other dealers that were learning about these films who were coming along. So you had old people and young people, which fit our personalities, like
sure.
We talked about earlier, is we liked old people when we were growing up. So you had the old people and the young people, but not those in between, the huge market. And it's kind of the same today to a certain extent. But for Cal, he thought he could make that bridge over and have bestsellers in the film history. And by God, he'd be the first to do it, basically, which he would have been. The biographies would do well, but he wasn't interested in biography, which is interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
He was interested in the manufacturing. How did they, behind the scenes, make these movies? And what were the stories? He often quotes storylines because he was fascinated in, well, the serial doesn't exist, but what was the topic of the serial? Many, many years later, I got a call from Kevin. And he said, you know, my father talks about you a lot and gets very nostalgic. And I said, oh, my God. He said, I'm sure he would love to hear from you. He gave me the phone number. I lost it.
Oh.
And I've never, it would probably take a detective to track him down. Cal wanted nothing to do with film history from that point, from the early, I think the Seelig book came out in 80, didn't it? Or
something like that.
The Seeley book had come out and that was it. No more.
He's still alive?
I think so.
Yikes.
Being a Korean.
I got to get him on the podcast.
You know, a Korean. Wow. You know, two people who would be extraordinary. Tom Seller was the guy that Sam Rubin convinced to actually organize what became Cinecon.
Mm-hmm.
I have all my correspondence with Tom Seller because I approached Sam Rubin and in turn Tom Seller about this organization that's being talked about, which became the Cinecon organization. Yeah. So they wanted my input. So I have all my letters of what it could be, that, you know, we could have an annual meeting, believe it or not. That was next year, will be its 50th anniversary. But Tom Seller is someone that I think should be talked to. Well, David Shepard should have a huge oral history, obviously.
Oh, sure.
And, well, several Tony slides, another one. But Cal Lahue, if he would talk, if he's reached that time in his life that maybe he would, could be extremely interesting, because he could tell you whether I'm off base or not, because I'm going on my reactions. I was so pleased when I heard from Kevin, you know, that, well, my father's often talked about you and very wow. nostalgically. But, you know, once he gave me the photos, which would have been in the early 80s, which, of course, you know, I still have. These were used in his books. And there was one or two other times I had seen him where I said, you know, are you getting any letters, or have you found anything else that you didn't throw away? And he goes, no, it's all thrown away. So, you know, the last thing, as far as I know, that he had relating to the subject that he kept were the pictures he gave me. I hope he kept his copies of his books. I had him sign Clown Princes and Court Jesters, because he goes, to him, he was not a sentimentalist. He kind of went at film history like the guys and gals who made silent film went after making movies.
Sure.
People don't understand. When you are making a movie, and a lot of people still don't understand that, when they go off in the semiotics or film theory, is just such nonsense.
Sure.
Because if you're making a movie, that's your whole focus. And to do it, you always have problems. You have good things. You have accidents and wonderful accidents and terrible accidents. Always. And so Cal Lahue, in a way, his book writing, I think, was, I did it. I put my heart and soul in it, every penny I had, and it got me nowhere. So now I'm fine. And so it's curious that the few times I tried to find an address or phone number, I couldn't find one, so I don't think he's listed, and I'm not sure. I haven't really seen him since the early 80s, so... Oh. Kevin was the son's name, so Kevin Lahue might be listed somewhere. And if you could get him, then you could ask. If you do find out anything, I'd really love to hear it.
Well,
I hope I'm not saying anything that he would be really angry at.
I can't imagine.
I think he'd get a kick out of my telling about the all in black thing, because, you know, that was a phase that he was going through, I think. And later, of course, with Larry Flint down on at the building very close to where the Academy is,
yeah.
There was a while there as I was going by Larry Flint's office every day, and Rob Stone and I had gotten the idea of doing this shorts project, which, you know, we're still kind of working on it on our own, but it was a $2.2 million project, which was a 10-year project to document all American silent short films from 1911 to 1930, all of them. In fact, the offer still stands, if anyone is interested. But Rob does what he can on short films at Library of Congress. And, of course, I do what I can helping scholars. So that's, you know, kind of where that ended. But I'd hope he would, you know, say, well, you know, you don't know anything about the whole other half of my life, almost.
Yeah.
So... you know, I would love to know it. I mean, I guess he'd probably have grandchildren and great-grandchildren.
Yeah, possibly.
And so I guess it'd be wonderful if he wouldn't mind getting in touch. You know, I'll be down there for Cinecon. And if you find out anything before Cinecon, I might actually go try and look him up.
Well, I never...
I don't know. He might say, oh, no. Or he may not be able to, or physically or something, but... I can't tell you how many people have asked me about him. And
well, I've never known anything about him, and so
that's more.
This is like pure gold to me, just to hear this much. And
You know, sometimes I've felt that, you know, someone should do a book on film history, film historians, because there's some real early interesting, you probably heard about, I just recently learned, you know, that Thief Catcher, I think it's called, the Keystone film that had Chaplin in it, was in a Chaplin filmography in the 30s by a British film scholar. He knew it. And apparently it was Theodore Huff, whom I was a god to me as a child. But I guess it was Huff who thought, well, I can't prove that. I can't verify. And pulled it out.
Wow.
Someone pulled it out. And so it actually is in the filmography from the 30s. And someone like Terry Ramsey, Earl Tyson, who was the motion picture curator at the Natural History Museum, which has a lot of film stuff, who in the late 20s felt like he needed to contact all the great cinema pioneers and establish a correspondence, and they started giving him things. And all that stuff is at the Academy or the Natural History Museum. You're talking late 20s and early 30s. There was an article in the mid-20s about we need a museum in Hollywood. Ha, ha, ha. I mean, maybe the Academy will eventually get one on Vine. But so that was in 1925. Douglas Fairbanks says one thing that the Academy will be doing, it will serve as an archives for the film industry.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the archives wasn't really established till 1975, and I was the first archivist. Not film, but the papers. So that I have an interest in that. And then I learned that Howard Lamar Walls, who was the curator of motion pictures at the Academy in the late 40s to early 50s, started an oral history program called the Voice History Project. And he interviewed J. Searle Dolly of the Edison Company and Albert E. Smith of the Vitagraph Company.
Gee.
I don't mean to knock UCLA, because they know now, but UCLA used to say it had the oldest oral history program west of the Rockies, because Columbia had the oldest. And they were basing that on the Albert E. Smith interviews, oral history, which Howard Walls did. But I verified this with Howard Walls to make sure, because he's the one who's interviewing Smith. He said, no, that was done for the Academy, for the Voice History Project. So I went back to Jim Mink at UCLA and said, Jim, I have something. It's going to be a horrible bit of news, so you need to sit down. Because they had nothing in all those later years until they...
Sure.
So I proved it to him. I sent him all the literature. He said, no, you're going to have to prove this. So I sent him all the literature. And he said, God damn, you know. I know he didn't say that, but he said, I can't believe that UCLA can't, the Academy is going to take claim now. Well, they did too. He had lined up Sidney Olcott, believe it or not, who died within a matter of months.
Oh.
And he had D.W. Griffith set, ready to go, but Mr. Walls told me I didn't get to it. He died on me. He said, I did talk with both of them. They were both willing to, and they both died on me. And says, and I kind of got disillusioned, and I got off onto other things. But, you know, it was fun for me to also meet Howard Lamar Walls, because Theodore Huff and then later Walls was the one who discovered, quote unquote, the paper print at the Library of Congress, which opened a whole new area. But, you know, I think what you're doing is fantastic. I really do mean it, though. I hope you edit this down to maybe 30 minutes. Because
No.
You know.
No, every word from you is pure gold, Sam.
Your wife went ahead and had something for lunch. If she hasn't had anything for lunch, she may have me for lunch.
She might. We will deal with her when the time comes.
Okay.
But we do have to stop. It's gone way too long, and I don't want to wear you out. I could talk to you for 4 straight days, and maybe next time I come up, we will. But we'll stop now, and then we'll do it again some other time. And, you know, I just can't thank you enough. I've been looking forward to this for a long, long time.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
That was such a great day with Sam Gill. in Niles, sitting in that historic little bungalow he lives in. And later on, he and my wife Claire and our great friend Jeff Haas and our little godson Atticus, whom we call Hoot, went to lunch together. And so we kept talking with Sam for a lot longer. I'm afraid I wore him out that day, or wore out his vocal cords anyway. But it was a memorable day for me. And as I mentioned before, Claire loves him to death, so it was a memorable day for her as well. And we just had a great time. And who knows? Atticus is only 2, or was at the time of this conversation, which was in July 2013. Maybe hearing all this silent movie talk and being in Niles will seep into his little bones and he'll be the next generation of film historians. Or maybe not. We'll see. We'll see. Time will tell. You can go to the website, thecommentarytrack.com, and buy my books and see some videos that I've worked on. I'm afraid there are virtually no copies left of the lost remake of Beaugest, but there are, I think, 4 left. So if you hear this and you want one, you should probably get one. I'm not saying that I will never reprint. This is not in some sort of weird threat to get people to rush and buy it. But judging from the level of interest that I've gotten so far, I can't imagine what's going to lead me to make another printing of this DVD. That might happen. Suddenly there might be some sort of weird surge. Who knows? But for the time being, this is all. And I hope that there will be 4 of you who are still interested in seeing it and haven't yet acted. And now you can. Just go to the website, thecommentarytrack.com, and you will find it. Let me thank my wife, Claire McCullough, for being my wonderful announcer. Thank James Hutchins for designing the websites, thecommentarytrack.com and frankthompson.tv. Thanks always to Rob Clearfield and Gary Rand for writing my wonderful theme music for and aft. And thank you, the listener, my wonderful listeners, for spreading the word, telling others to give this podcast a listen, for going to iTunes and leaving nice reviews and 5-star ratings. And just generally helping to build an audience for this. 60 episodes is quite a lot. We're going on 1.5 years now. It gets discouraging sometimes, but I get the nicest comments from people. The people who do listen seem to like it very much. And I just wish that there were lots more people to listen. So that I could attract advertisers and somehow make this a going concern. Instead, it's just a concern. I'm very concerned. So, got another great guest for you next week, and I hope that you will tune in then. And in the meantime, don't you worry. We'll fix it in post.